So today's and Friday's exercise will be one and the same because it's a larger exercise. And it is my best attempt to say, where can I find real data which have a built-in sort of a mind of a set of problems where you, through careful data analysis, can sort of work your way through. What is this data? What does it look like? What does it look like for signal and background? And that is the so-called Atlas test beam data. And I know some of you might think, oh no, that's particle physics. I know nothing about particle physics. You don't need to know anything about particle physics or physics for that matter, because the data, I might as well have taken the Atlas test beam data and said that it was from cancer research or from marketing or from a biological system. It doesn't matter. What does matter is that slowly but surely, you will hopefully find out that there are two species, in this case of particles, but might have well been patients, and that they are recorded by three independent detectors. I'll go through it with images in a moment, but it was just to sort of say, where can you find real data, large amounts of it? And by large amounts, here's lots of data. I specifically decided to make it smaller than it really is, just so that it doesn't take too long to run and fits in memory and all of these things. I will walk through the exercise to begin with. And it's one where where I hope you will be working in small groups as always, but also how to understand each part. And it's not a really a fitting exercise here, because real data rarely fits any of the PDFs that are sort of easily available. But let's see. So let me start by introducing this data. And some of you might say, well, don't you usually go through last week's or last exercise? Yes, last exercise was on machine learning. The interesting thing is that you can use that exercise on this data, and I'll point out where. There's a natural extension, and that's also the reason why I wanted to start with the fun and machine learning and then move to this data set. On the other hand, you don't need to use machine learning on it at all. So what is the Atlas test beam data? Well, the smell of real data in the morning. The data consists of a large number of events where a charged particle, here either an electron or a pion, passed through a slice of the Atlas detector. It's actually from before the Atlas detector was assembled, but one had single parts of it, and they were put into a test beam to see how did Atlas work when we put all the detectors one after each other. And so each particle's passage is recorded by different detectors, essentially three independent detectors, which boils down to 11 numbers. And some are more relevant than others. Some are completely irrelevant. And the exercise is to first order to separate electrons from pions, events or particles based on these numbers, and then turn this information into measuring interactions of electrons and pions separately. Right? So first you have a big pile where you don't know, is this an electron or a pion? And then slowly you find out how to identify it as an electron or a pion. And then you can answer questions about, how much energy does a pion on average leave in the second layer of the electromagnetic calorimeter? Which might as well be the question, what fraction of the those with cancer smoked when they were young, but not when they were old, or the likes. And the data is from particle physics, but as I keep saying, it could be from any other source. It doesn't really matter. What matters is that you're able to read the data, plot the data, understand the data, use the data, and get information out. All right, and then there's a question, how do you get 11 numbers from two types of particles and three detectors? That's because each detector may give more than one number. I'll go into that in more detail. And so with this in mind, I hope that you, and hopefully in groups as much as you can, will work your way through the data. And an essential element of this is that the different detectors are independent. There are independent measurements of the same particle. And this feature is the fantastic part. This is what allows you to say, all right, I can use A, variable A, to make sure it's an electron, and now I can look at the distribution of variable B for electrons. And then you might say, but variable A might not be good enough to give me a clean sample of electrons. Sure, but maybe you say, I take all with A above this value, and they're mostly electrons, and I take all with A below another value, they're mostly not electrons. And then from that, I can deduce what the distribution is for electrons in other dimensions, in other variables. And this is very much what you do in essentially all fields, that you have some smart way of knowing, it may not be smart, way of knowing what was really behind the case. In cancer research or in medicine in general, it might be that you simply wait 5 years and see who got ill and who didn't. And then afterwards, you can look back at the measurements you have and say, but the fact that I know what they are is independent from me measuring this variable. Now I'm going to see to what extent this variable was a good indicator or not. Okay. All right. So let's continue down the hallway of data. And let's get all that part away. So let's look at the Atlas test beam setup. It looks like this. And the particles come from lower left side. It's either an electron or a pion. And it goes through first a Cherenkov detector. And the Cherenkov detector was not part of the Atlas detector, but people were smart when doing this setup. They said, we can have two independent detectors, or we can have three independent detectors. And it's going to be a lot easier if we have three. So we're going to put in a Cherenkov detector, which is going to help us understand all of this data. And then it goes through this part, a magnet where it bends a little bit so we can measure the momentum, but that doesn't matter. They're all at the same momentum. And then it goes through this little detector here, which is called the transition radiation tracker, also called TRT. And the TRT can record a difference between whether things are electrons or pions. I'll get back to exactly how. But it's, if you have seen the light patterns on the Niels Bohr Institute at night, then it's actually data from the transition radiation tracker recorded up there. There are 96 channels on the facade of NBI. There is 300,000 in the transition radiation tracker. And then next, it goes through two calorimeters. One is an electromagnetic calorimeter and one is a hadronic calorimeter. And again, a third place where you can see the difference between electrons and pions, because electrons will be stopped here, whereas pions will sometimes be stopped here, but sometimes go in here to the hadronic calorimeter. And also the electromagnetic calorimeter has four layers. There are three in the hadronic. So there you get seven numbers from this, and their distribution is different for electrons and pions with an overlap. So you cannot be sure, but you can get pretty far. And the rest of it is all things we don't care about. We care about these three, the Cherenkov, the TRT, and the calo. There is one number coming from the muon part, and you may look at it and you may see if you see something interesting with regards to today's exercise. But that will be a cross-check, I hope, of seeing that it's irrelevant. Now, all of this looks very nice and neat and well-drawn and so on. Welcome to the reality. Real data is dirty wires and misplaced things and material in between the ruins, whatever you want to measure, all of these things. So that is why it is real data. And it has, it's not Gaussian. It has tails that you don't know about. All of these things. And here you can sort of see, here's the beamline coming in, and here's the transition radiation that the Cherenkov is before. The electromagnetic calorimeter, the hadronic calorimeter put, you know, somewhere different. And then the muon chamber that we don't care about. So now I hope you understand why real data is hardly ever perfect. Now, the individual detectors. What happens? And now you're going to get 3 minutes of particle physics, but you don't need to memorize it. You just need to know what does electrons do and what does pions do. Electrons travel very, very close to the speed of light because they are so light, whereas pions travel slightly slower, both at 99%. But if you travel faster than speed of light in a medium, then you emit Cherenkov radiation. And so you can put a Cherenkov where you put a gas in here, and through the pressure, you can make sure that electrons travel faster than speed of light, but pions don't. So electrons will emit Cherenkov radiation and it will be detected here while the particle goes through. And it's not a perfect thing, but it means that for pions, you get pretty much a low signal, and for electrons, you get a high signal. So if you have a high value of Cherenkov, you're more likely to be an electron. In the TRT, you get two numbers. What happens? Well, a particle runs out through a whole series of straws in a hexagonal pattern. So the particle track is the blue here, and the straws that said I got hit are the red ones here. So not all straws get hit. Typically between 30 and 35 gets hit, but it may be higher, it may be lower. And here, you get a pulse out for each. And if the pulse is above some low level, low threshold, then that's what makes it red. And essentially, if a charged particle, electron or pion, passes through, it will give that hit. So this is more to say, well, both electrons and pions will give a hit here. So there's no difference here. But electrons will occasionally give a very large signal. And then the signal will come above the high threshold. And then you will get a high threshold count. So of course you can't get more high threshold counts than you have low threshold counts. And typically you have many fewer. The chance for an electron to get a high threshold hit is approximately 20%, whereas it's 6% for a pion. So if you have 30 hits, you would expect on average 1.8. And well, 6% is low, 30 is high. It's probably Poisson distributed. You could take it as a binomial, which is probably not a bad idea. And also the binomial distribution fits because 20% is not a low P. So you would expect 6 high threshold hits and 30 low threshold hits for an electron. But as you know, that's a distribution and they overlap. And then, well, I summarize that here. So N low threshold can be seen as the number of chances that a particle has to produce a high threshold hit. And that means that the number of low threshold hit might not be completely irrelevant. And then for the calorimeter, and here I'm only showing the electromagnetic calorimeter. So the particle comes through here and traverses first a thin layer, and then this relatively thin, but much thicker, and then the main part layer 2, and then a back part layer 3. And here is what it looks like when an electron makes a shower in here. And typically, it doesn't leave too much in layer 3, but it does leave a lot in layer 1, more than pions would typically do. Pions mostly do sort of more irregular pattern and sometimes go through and leave energy in the last part. So you get 7 numbers, energies, 4 from the electromagnetic calorimeter as shown and 3 from behind. And this should be 0 for electrons, but may or may not be 0 for pions. And also negative energies may occur simply because the energy read out, the number that you get, is some value where you subtract the background level. And so sometimes that gives a negative number. It shouldn't give a deeply negative number. So your analysis, what should that look like? Well, as always, and even before showing anything, how about taking the data, reading it in, looking at the numbers and saying, okay, so that's what I should expect, and plotting it. And for that, I'm simply gonna jump out and jump to, where do we have it? Did I close it? I did. Hang on. Here I have the code. Let's try again. Here we are. So here's the code. And I specifically went ahead and, you know, just printed some, the first 20 numbers. I think that's a super healthy thing to do whenever you have new data. All right, so I look at the sharing cuff and I say, well, what's the minimum value? Okay, 560 or something like that. Okay, and there are values up to almost 1,000. And my prediction of the number of low threshold and high threshold seem reasonable. Okay, here there's one with 12 high threshold. If it's true what I said, that it had a 6% chance, then, well, I shouldn't see 12 hits. So that one is likely an electron. Okay, it also has a high value of the sharing cuff, so that looks good. And there's 0 in the hadronic and 0 in the last one and a lot in the first one. This all looks like an electron. Can I see others? Well, this one might be a case as well, the last one. All right. And also it looks like the data looks nice. There are no strange not a number values or so on. That's not a guarantee. I would check for that. Okay, now we plot it. Here goes your analysis. But I think plotting it is a nice thing to do. What do we get in the sharing cuff? Well, we get some with a low value. It seems like there are two populations here. Something with a low value and something with a higher value reaching up to, okay, 1200 or something like that. And if we look at just the first layer of the electromagnetic calorimeter, I said electrons would have a reasonably high. There's also two very distinct populations here. Agree? Well, I hope. And well, if I plot them in 2D, I see that there is a correspondence. When you're low here, you're also low here. That gives this point. And I look at that and they're not correlated, right? It's two independent detectors. And here, well, wouldn't it look like these were the pions? And then, well, out here, we would have the electrons. This means that, well, looking at this, it might be hard to separate them with this alone. And it might be not hard, but not perfect to separate them with this alone. I don't know if there's some part of this that is electrons that goes like this and some part of this that goes like that. Likewise here. But hey, I can see from this that most likely, if I put a selection which is low here and low here and high here and high here, I should get reasonably clean samples. I don't know how clean yet, but the good thing is now I can start looking at the TRT and know how good the TRT is. Notice I haven't looked at the TRT yet. And when I know how good the TRT is, I can do the same with the shearing cuff of the TRT, and I can start investigating how good the electromagnetic calorimeter is, and then the shearing cuff. And once I've gone through that, I will have numbers regarding, okay, what is the false positive and the false negative rate, you know, the errors of type 1 and type 2. And I'll be able to establish how good are each detector, how many are electrons overall, and how clean samples can I get. Yeah. So let's go back to the slides, to your analysis. Well, so generally we want, well, I would like you to try to separate electrons and pions as well as you can. And once you've done that, you also need to determine how well you can do it with each detector. And that means in the end, you should draw a ROC curve for the shearing cuff, for the TRT, and for the calorimeter. And now you should imagine that people come around and say, okay, but how do electrons do in the TRT, for example? And you should be able to answer that because you can get a clean sample of electrons and get information out of that way. And you don't have to, I ask a lot of questions. That's why it's a two exercise problem. But you don't have to follow them blindly. They are meant sort of to trigger your, okay, which numbers do I need to get out and so on. And also just start by considering the data and get a feel for the typical ranges of values and so on. And so you have numbers from the shearing cuff, from the TRT, and from the calorimeters. From the shearing cuff, there's just one number. So there's not a lot to work with, right? That's going to be the shearing cuff number. But already for the TRT, there were two numbers. Is there some smart way of combining them that gives a better number than any one of them? And if so, how? How would you motivate that? Could you try it? How would you know if it was better? Well, you can draw a ROC curve and say, okay, it is actually better now. The ROC curve separates them more. And the real challenge lies in the calorimeters, because EM1 seems to be a good variable. I just showed it before, but there are seven numbers here. And wouldn't they be somehow combinable into something that's better? And the answer is yes, they are. And there are several ways of doing it. You can do it with a Fisher, or you can do it with machine learning. And so you may choose however you do. And I would say first, don't do it, just use EM1 to sort of establish and get a feel for what you know. So if you manage to answer the entire exercise today, then I would say play with the Fisher and machine learning on Friday. And if you don't, well, play with the rest of the exercise on Friday. Now, it's the independency that makes this a special problem, because imagine that you made a selection based on the shearing cuff and the TRT and then looked at the calorimeters. But if the distributions in the calorimeters were changed by the fact that you made a selection on these, then you would think that you saw the truth in the calorimeters, but in reality, you didn't. That would not be beautiful. And likewise, maybe it's good to try to test if they're independent. But this is hard, I would say. So one is glad that it's from three different detectors, and I've even shown you a photo that it's three different detectors. Now, there's little fitting in this exercise, but that is because the distributions are not very simple. And I know people will typically go and say, all right, but I think I can fit this. Here we are, right? You look at the distribution and you say, well, here's a Gaussian and here's a Gaussian. That's nice. Well, this would go down here. So that's not a very good fit. And because this spikes up here, tells you nothing about if there's a long tail underneath here. You don't know. You don't know until you used the two other detectors to isolate pions and then plot this distribution for pions. And saying you might try to fit this with a Gaussian, this one might even do well, but you don't know if there's a long tail. And here, this is certainly not Gaussian. Okay, so, but there is one thing that you can fit and that I would very much like you to fit, and that is the tier T. So if you take all the tracks which have exactly 35 low threshold hits, now you know that N is 35 for all of these. And assuming that for electrons, there's a certain probability of a high threshold hit, and for pions, there's a certain one, then you can fit that distribution. And you can do it in two ways. You can say first I'm gonna try to separate using the Cherenkov and the calorimeters. I'm gonna separate pions and separate electrons and do a fit with a simple single binomial and see if it fits. And hopefully it does. But what you can also do is in fact to say, I'm gonna take every single candidate with 35 hits in this sample, and I'm going to fit it with two binomials because either it's an electron or it's a pion, and they should be very different, and you should get two peaks out. And in this way, you can actually say what fraction of the events are in reality pions and what fraction are electrons based on one detector only, because you can make a fit. So the goal here, well, I can say that full PhD theses have been written about this data. I had the great chance to go to Australia and for a short while be in the Sydney and Melbourne groups in Atlas. And there was a super cool guy in Melbourne who had been writing much of his PhD thesis about this data. And I had also analyzed this data, and we hadn't spoken at all. And he was about to hand in his thesis, and he said, oh, I'm a little worried if we start comparing the two. But we did so, of course, scientists as we are. And as it turned out, we got very, if not identical, the near identical numbers based on the same data set, but two different, very different analyses. But the same line of thinking, not unlike the table measurement where, well, different analyses will lead you different places, but hopefully with consistent numbers. Now, just before I finish, Lasse asks, are there no theoretical predictions or previous measured numbers of these detector distributions? Could we not fit data this way? Well, there are simulations. You cannot theoretically predict it because it gets too complicated, but you can simulate it, and we have done so in very high detail. I would say it's at the verge of being able to fit with that, but you can, right? You can fit with a histogram, that is possible. And we've done that extensively, but I would worry that in this case, it would make things harder. So you don't need to fit. You just need to make a selection in the data and say, okay, how many passed this selection? Do I believe that it's electrons or pions? I hope that answers your question, Lasse. So, because even if you had a good simulation, it's never perfect, and it's much better to do it from the real data. And so this is real data in its near perfect form, because it's simple, 11 variables, that's nothing. And it's very structured, right? You get one line for each. It's a well-planned experiment. It has three independent detectors for measuring this. The data has been cleaned. People have been doing a lot of work on it before it got to you. Yet, it has challenges, flaws, and strange correlations. Now I get the question about strange correlations. Well, Jamie, the numbers measured by the calorimeters will have correlations. That doesn't mean that they're correlated with the TRT and the Cherenkov, but in the calorimeter by itself, things will be correlated. Because if a particle loses a lot of energy early on, then it will tend to lose less energy later on, but not necessarily in a linear manner. All right. So my hope is that you will throw yourself boldly at the data and have fun with it. And I predict that in your future analysis careers, you will hit upon a case like this. It could be marketing data, right? What number of hours have people used on this product? Well, is there a theoretical curve for that? Hell no, there is no theoretical curve for that, right? You will have to live with, and I can tell you what people answer, people and how they behave, there is no theoretical curve for that because that is just damn complicated. So you can't, there is no fitting. You will have to try to divide it in smart ways. And this data was made in a smart way, namely with independent measurements, and then see if you from that can get a hint of what the others look like. Yeah. Questions, comments, anything, please. Please speak up.
Out of pure interest, how could somebody move faster than the speed of light in a medium? Maybe I haven't had enough physics to understand it, but that seems pretty interesting.
No, it's index of refraction. So the reason why light bends when it goes into water is that in water, it travels at approximately 2/3 of its speed. But particles like an electron or a pion will travel near speed of light in the water. And so in the water, they travel faster than speed of light. The only rule is that in vacuum, they can't do it, and they don't.
So it's the faster than the relative speed of light in that medium.
It's in that medium.
Yeah. Okay. Then it makes more sense.
All right. And there's a question. Is any calibration and normalization of the data needed? I would tend to say no. None is needed. These are nice values. I would always with data, start by checking out if the data is really all there, right? Because some of your algorithms might fail when it has minus 999 in it or not a number or, you know, weird things. And it might be that you have to cut away a little of the data to begin with. Remember with the table measurements, you know, some things are just bad and you should throw things away when it is, right? So minus 999 is not a likely value for something between 0 and 2. All right, and there's a question with 2D plot. Do you then mean just 2D scatter plot or 2D histogram like we did with the calibration? Well, it doesn't mean, it could mean either. Scatter plot or 2D histogram is fine. What we did in the calibration was that we boiled the 2D histogram down into a 1D plot by taking in one dimension the values and taking the mean and the uncertainty and the mean. But that's not what we are doing here. Okay. Well, no need to extend it, but I think, as always, that we should take a good long break. So let's take a break until 20 minutes past 2. And then start on it there. All right. See you then.